Good evening. January 14th, 2010, James McCanney with my Science Hour going right into the show tonight. A little bit of explanation. Last week I talked about a very unusual story. And it's always interesting when I do this because I get varied reactions. A lot of people really liked it and other people did not like it. But as with any weekly show, topics are not always what everybody wants to hear. But let me explain why I did last week's show, concentrating on a topic of international banking. Now, what does that have to do with science? Actually, quite a bit. As I said, Obama, it's one of the very first words out of his mouth when he talked about the Christmas bomber. Isn't it interesting that they pull these shenanigans? I mean, this was obviously a CIA plant. Everybody knows it, including the stupid media. If the stupid media knows about it and talks about it, it must be really obvious. I mean, really, really, really obvious. So anyway, but the idea that science is related to what is going on in the world of politics and banking is very related, because they need science and technology to control the public, to measure the public, to understand the public, to listen to what the public is saying, to phone conversations, to calculating statistics on public reaction, etc. But let me go back to last week's show where I talked about a investment company in Latin America, starting it ran through, as I said, the countries Panama, Venezuela, Colombia, Peru, and other South American countries, concentrating in a couple of those countries. But literally, here's what the downfall of all of this occurred when common people, small people, little people, poor people, if you want to call them that, those are not very nice names, but those are the names that the bankers give to the common person. The common person in these countries was going to the bank and withdrawing all of their money, their life savings, and taking it across the street and depositing it with someone who was providing them with an unusual service, a very high rate of return. And one might think, well, this was just some poor people. It turns out that some of the highest level people in governments were also involved in the same thing, taking a good deal of their money and depositing it in this private corporation, which was totally legitimate. But what was the problem? That was so successful that people were literally going line, they were lined up down the block and around the corner, standing in line, and every person stood there waiting his turn or her turn to take all their money out of the bank. It was causing a run on the bank. And so at any rate, therein lie the problem with this entire. So if you missed last week's show, be sure to listen to it. But understand that, first of all, the reason I did that show and concentrated on that topic, because, number one, there was no true coverage in the Western press. Also, it was a topic unheard of in the big daytime talk show host circuits. So when those factors occur, I take liberty to use this show, not all the time, just very rarely, but I take liberty to put on my show these topics, and I go out and research them and bring you news that you would simply not hear anyplace else. And that's what makes this show relatively powerful, because the big daytime talk show hosts then look pretty foolish if they don't pick up these topics. But remember, a lot of them are controlled, and so these issues, there are certain things they just don't talk about. That's how you tell the controlled shows There's certain topics they just don't breach the topic on those shows. So at any rate, and also the other reason I did last week's show, three national governments crossing international boundaries coordinated to bring an end to this competition with the international banking cartel. Okay, so that's all I'll say about that. But I had to explain why I did last week's show. So if you missed last week's show, be sure to listen to it and then re-listen to this explanation, and it'll probably make a lot more sense. All right, weather is the topic of the day. That'll be the main science topic for tonight, and I'm going to go right into talking about the weather. This is unprecedented, what is happening to the Earth today. The cold spell that is occurring all the way to just about to the equator. The winds coming from the pole, the jet streams coming down. Very far south, Florida, it was snowing in Miami this past week. I just have to chuckle because it's not funny, but in a sense, when I talk to people from that area, they don't know what to do. It's snowing in Miami. They thought they moved down there for winter sun and warmth, but not exactly the case. Fog in India, where it's typically dry and arid, and so you need cool weather and then moisture also. India with fog. All of these stories, I'm sure you heard, I talked a bit about this last week, the train that left Beijing got buried in a snowbank as it hit this snowdrift with that area had received 2 meters of snow at one time, unheard of amounts of activity, very cold activity. And then last but not least, something I think a lot of people saw was the satellite photo of England, and they said right now England has a larger ice cap than Antarctica. Truly amazing. Now that is not as deep as Antarctica, thank goodness for the people in England, but in surface area, we're talking about surface area. So a truly amazing cold snap. But what does this mean? Where does it come from? What's going on, and how long is this going to last? Those are the big questions. Now let's go back historically and look at what has happened in the distant past. Now there was an epoch called the Maunder Minimum. And in history, this was a time when the sunspot count went down. Now, sunspots are a very subtle activity in the working of the solar system. Typically, sunspots do not activate directly Earth weather, and there are some clowns around the internet running around going, oh, sunspots cause Earth weather. No, they don't. Sunspots are really very unrelated to Earth weather, but when the sunspot count goes to zero and stays at zero for 700, 800 days over a couple of years during the solar minimum, then something very unusual happens. The sun quiesces and actually cools down a bit. And therefore, the energy reaching the Earth is reduced. And they had a couple years of winter, year-round, and starvation was rampant. So it's very difficult to predict the weather. And I'm not one that's going to say, okay, we are heading into another Maunder Minimum. But a couple of issues here. Science, standard science, is not reporting this. They're pretending as if everything is fine and, oh, don't mind that we don't have sunspots. It's okay. We'll come back and have a regular solar cycle. Well, that might be true, but historical evidence suggests that that is not the case. So if trends in the past are any indication of the future, and that's really the only thing we have to go by in this type of analysis, then the future could bring a year or two or even more of cropless summers. Now imagine this. Now one thing I want to make very clear, planting seeds and maintaining seed banks has been something that's been historically done throughout the world. And when I had my corn program here, when I sold the corn seeds and distributed those worldwide, I put in some information, and it's very important to understand that with real seed, non-hybrid seed, non-GMO seed, for example, with corn, that's a great example, you can take a very small amount of seed, say 300 seeds, and generate a crop. Okay, now there's a 100-fold multiplication in the number of seeds you get on that first year. So say you take 300 seeds. Okay, now you have 30,000 seeds. That's a lot. That's enough to give to your friends and pretty much everybody you know after 1 year. And after the second year, you have enough seed to plant a lot, pretty much across the country. And so the point is that natural seed is something that can be regenerated, and it can last more than a year. Now let's look at hybrid seed, genetically modified or genetically altered seed stock. You can go through Kansas or Iowa through the summer, and you'll see these fields lined up one after another, and they have these little signs sticking up, and they have the seed company that is growing that corn or grain as seed. And these farmers have their land tilled for just growing seed, and then it's sold to the seed company, and that is used for the next planting year. But if you have a failure with hybrid seed, there is no continuation. It ends. It ends right there. It's a one-season program. And so with hybrid seeds, which is the dominant form of seed right now for many of our types of plants, for many of the vegetables that we eat, you would be surprised, apples, fruit, that are hybrid, that don't produce seeds. How about seedless grapes? Look at all of the types of fruit you can buy, and the seeds will not grow, will not produce a offspring. If you planted them, they simply would not grow. Hybrid, genetically modified to produce nice big fruit, vegetables, corn, grain, etc. But the problem with all of those seed lines is that they end. They end after a single season. And so there's no way to plant. Remember a guy named Johnny Appleseed? He wore a pan on his head, and he walked around, this is the fable anyway, planting apples trees all over the countryside. And that was his thing. Johnny Appleseed, they called him, and he went around planting apple seeds, and those apples are growing all over the country. A lot of those old trees have been cut down, and a lot of the old apple stock has disappeared. But you can go to a lot of old farms, and especially farms that are no longer in existence, but you can see the foundation there. There's always an apple tree next to that farmhouse. Always, always. And it was one of the mainstays of one of the ways to get some sort of fruit in a northern cold climate. But at any rate, the point is that seed stock is very important, especially if you're heading into a time like the Maunder Minimum back through the Middle Ages. But what if we are heading into such a time now where the summer, say, where the summer and just doesn't come on time, it's not warm enough? That actually happened last spring, when in the previous planting season, when farmers planted their crops, some of them a little early because they wanted to get a head start. They thought it was going to be warm, and the gamble did not pay off. They had to totally reseed because there was cold, wet snap, and especially the corn did not grow. So they had to completely reseed their fields. This now, if the main point I want to make here is that with hybrid seed, it is a one season to one season process. So with if we went into a Maunder minimum with year after year, say 2 or 3 years of cool weather where we're not going to get a crop, hybrid seed stock would fail and the world would starve to death. Now this is one of the bad aspects, certainly not planned with the agricultural planning groups. They think that, I remember when this first came into being, back in the 1960s, I lived in farming country, and all of the big farmers consolidated land, went out and bought more, bought big machinery, went to the university, and they came back with modern farming techniques. And this included hybrid seed stock and also ammonia fertilizers. All of that came in about the same time on a large scale. It was being taught at the universities. And so many of the other farmers followed suit. And the small family farm that used natural fertilizers went by the wayside. They were purchased. These were small, anywhere from usually 160 acres. You know, a quarter of a section or in that range. Some of them were small, 40 or 80 acres was a medium-sized farm. Very few people farmed 600 acres at that time. It was just not possible on the family farm. And they had the cows, a typical family farm. They had a number of fields which rotated crops. They had alfalfa hay in one field. They had corn in another, soybeans in another, and they would rotate the crops. And then they had their garden. They had their personal garden. They had cows. They had chickens. They had pigs. They had all of the farm animals, the typical family farm with the little red tractor that did all of the work on the family farm. And it was a beautiful little ecosystem. They had a pond with ducks. And the pond in the wintertime was a place for recreation, to skate, to have a fire, and to gather around the fire in the wintertime and skate on the pond. It was a beautiful existence, something that was destroyed by modern technology. But that's not the main point here. The point is that those farmers saved their own seed. This was not good for business for the seed companies. So they pushed all of these farmers to go to hybrid. They convinced them that they would get better yields, bigger yields, make more money if they turned to the hybrid seed stock. And a lot of them listened, and then eventually a lot of them lost out because they just couldn't make a living on the smaller family farm. Someone had to farm 600 or 1,200 acres. And then those people did quite well, but they had to go out and either rent or purchase vast amounts of land. At any rate, I'm not going to get into farming tonight, but the point is, in a cold spell of 2 or 3 years, which was, for example, during the Maunder minimum, say if that occurred today, modern farming as we know it would go under. This is a big problem. So I'm not saying this is going to happen. We could have a beautiful warm summer. Who knows? It's very difficult to predict the weather. But here is what is very unusual. There are two major points that may point in this direction. Number one, the long series of years, in fact, without sunspots, and I've been invited many, many times over the past number of years to appear on as a guest on Coast to Coast with George Norrie, and the main topic we talked about many times was the lack of sunspots. What's going on? Where is this leading to? What historical patterns can we look at to maybe estimate the future of what's going to happen? So in reality, we have set all records, but NASA, the standard science community, is minimizing this lack of sunspots. It's still being minimized. I just looked today on Space Weather, which announces all of the sunspot and coronal hole activity that's going on, including solar flares, anything like that. And any little dot on the sun, they're making a big deal about it, like, oh, here we are, sunspot, isn't this amazing? But in reality, we're way, way, way behind schedule. And they don't want to talk about it because the reality is that we could very well be heading into another Maunder minimum. Now, the weather speaks for itself. And here's the other major point. Point number two. When we have cold weather in North America, the jet stream typically brings this cold air from the Arctic Circle. In the upper Midwest, it's called an Alberta Clipper because the jet stream goes up to the North Pole, comes racing down at 600 miles an hour across Alberta and Saskatchewan down into the upper states of the 48 states. So it's extremely cold. Actually, when Alaska might be relatively temperate because it's getting warm air dragged up from the Pacific Ocean. So Alaska is warm because of warm air currents and ocean currents, and then that warm air passes up to the Arctic Circle, gets cold, it's cooled down, of course, then with moisture-laden air comes down across Alberta and Saskatchewan, that jet stream, as I said, 600 miles an hour, just racing down and dumping all that cold air. But this time it's not stopping. It's going all the way to Florida and beyond. And just unrelenting, keeping the very cold temperatures down that far south. But something else is happening, and here's the main idea on point number two. When it is cold like that here, now, one might say, well, that's not unusual. We haven't broken all that many records. Well, actually, we have. But when the jet stream snakes up and down, we typically have intermittent regions of hot and cold. And when the jet stream comes back up, it pulls up some warm air, which warms up the next region east as this jet stream moves easterly. It snakes up to the pole, down to the equator, up to the pole, down towards the equator. Maybe not all the way to the equator, maybe not all the way to the pole, but it's like a snake moving around the planet, moving in an easterly direction in the northern hemisphere. This time it's different. There is freezing conditions all around the northern hemisphere. We don't have this region of alternating hot, cold. Typically, if it's extremely cold in the northern hemisphere, in the United States, Europe and Russia are enjoying warm weather. If it's extremely moderate in the northern hemisphere in the United States, England, Europe, Russia are in the deep freeze. It alternates. And that's very typical. But this time it was different. The global cooling is universal and it goes very far south, as I said, to India. Now, if you look at a globe, and you look from the North Pole down, most of the land of the world is in the Northern Hemisphere. Also, most of the crop producing, the agriculture regions of the world, the ones that produce the bulk of the food eaten by the world, are in the Northern Hemisphere. So the question is, as we head into this cooling period, will it last? Will it extend into the summer? And not only this summer, but the next summer, and maybe the next summer. And are we headed into periods when we simply will have crop failure after crop failure after crop failure? That is the question. And so, given historical trends, the indicators, and like I say, it's very difficult to predict the weather. We could have a steamy, hot summer, the hottest summer on record. So that is possible. But given the indicators of the past, and that's the best we can do when predicting weather. Now, you're not going to see this on the Weather Channel or weather.com because they're supposed to give you the happy news that everything is normal and there's, you know, don't worry about it. That would be the message from the standard media. But, no, in this case, the indicators of the past, the Maunder minimum, and also the fact that we don't have alternating cold and hot cells as the jet stream snakes around the planet. In other words, the entire northern hemisphere all around the globe is cold, unseasonably cold, uncharacteristically cold. That tells me that there's a probability, a higher probability, that we are heading into a cooling trend. So isn't this amazing as our little president comes back from his global climate change meeting and trying to tell us that we're supposed to subdue to more taxation so they can fight global warming when the planet is going into a deep freeze? As I said on one show a number of weeks ago, as Obama returned from the International Conference on Global Climate Change, and of course the indication was that according to Al Gore, who also invented the internet, you know, so he must be pretty smart. But I say that facetiously, by the way. I hope for anybody out there that doesn't know me. But anyway, the belief in politics today, and they're using this for politics, is that the global warming has to be subsided. What does it do? It allows them to control, of all things, water. But as Obama was returning and he wanted to tax the public for carbon consumption, in other words, taxing you for the air you breathe, then as he returned to Washington, Washington, D.C. had the most severe, coldest, most snow storm of in recorded history. At the same time, England was experiencing the same thing. In fact, that's when, it was that weekend, ironically enough, when all of this severe cold weather really started. And so isn't it ironic that these politicians want to use global warming to further the one world government agenda, one world taxation unit through the United Nations for global warming, when we're headed into one of the most severe cooling trends known in history, and that includes during the Maunder minimum through the Middle Ages. We are heading into a deep freeze chill, and that really reflects on the energy coming out of the sun and the lack of sunspots. The fact that, as we know from history, when sunspot activity reduces to zero and stays there for extended amount of time, that indicates we're heading into a cooling trend. Okay, now, complicating the situation even further is the fact that NASA cannot measure accurately the energy output of the sun. Now, this has been actually an assignment of NASA. They were assigned to measure the energy output of the sun. And one would think that that would be relatively simple because the sun is just a big glowing ball out there. And if you put a satellite up and measured through the entire spectrum of the sun on a daily basis, on a minute-to-minute basis, you would certainly expect that you could measure the energy output of the sun and then, of course, measure the same thing at the surface of the Earth. That gets a little more difficult because you have the Earth atmosphere, which blocks, say we have a clear atmosphere, a beautiful blue sky. The atmosphere still is going to block a lot of the solar radiation before it ever hits the ground. In fact, if it weren't for our atmosphere and the blocking capability of the atmosphere, we'd all be dead because of the X-rays, the ultraviolet radiation, or we'd have very thick crusts on our back like a turtle to protect us from that radiation. But be that as it may, then you have the complication that there might be moisture in the air or other pollutants also blocking the visible and other types of light that normally would pass through the atmosphere. So it's very difficult to measure solar energy output from the surface of the Earth. But where does it really count? At the surface of the Earth, because that's where it, the heat comes in, that's where it creates a good deal of the heating of our planet as the planet turns around on its axis every 24 hours. So the lack of ability of NASA to measure the energy output of the sun is critical here. Now, the other point is maybe they can measure, maybe they're able to measure the energy output of the sun, but the problem is, will they tell us? Are they going to report to the public what is happening? Are they going to report that we're heading into a possible Maunder minimum? Maunder being the name of the man who discovered this relative to the sunspot count. And so that's back in the Middle Ages. Right now, we have a quandary. Nobody can trust NASA. So is NASA measuring this and not talking, or are they incompetent with their measuring capability and are unable to measure it? Either way you look at it, it doesn't bode well for NASA or the confidence that the public should have in NASA, because either they're measuring it and not telling us, or they're not measuring it, they're not capable of measuring it, and it should be a measurement which is relatively simple in terms of physics. Measuring the cross-section from infrared, from microwave infrared to through the visible spectrum, through ultraviolet, x-rays, and etc. But what's very discerning also is they keep trying to say, oh, it's cosmic rays from some other far galaxy that are the cosmic rays would be heating our atmosphere, which is absolutely absurd. That's that there is not enough energy, bulk energy, that is, to compare with the energy coming off of our sun on a daily basis. The cosmic rays tend to come in flashes. Certainly we've received severe flashes of cosmic rays, cosmic radiation, typically relativistic protons, and that type of radiation, but it's not the thing that's creating our weather. Now, add another complication that the electrical energy of the solar system is one of the elements, one of the factors that helps heat up Earth. There's a lot of confusion about El Niño and La Niña, El Niño being the heating of the Pacific Ocean on the surface. Now, once again, NASA claims, Standard Science claims, that this somehow affects hurricane activity in the Atlantic Ocean, and etc., but the real cause of El Niño is energy that comes out from outside the planet by way of electrical energy. That same electrical energy in the Atlantic Ocean forms the hurricanes. Once again, Standard Science stating that hurricanes are caused by warm water. Absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous concepts being pawned off to the public as true scientific concepts. So you have some real problems here in that NASA either is measuring and not telling, or not measuring and is incompetent. Which one is worse? I'm not sure. But the other thing is, all of the standard theories regarding weather, they simply do not acknowledge that electrical activity is extremely important in the production of Earth weather. Our severe storm systems are produced electrically. They are driven by electrical currents from outer space as Earth passes through and discharges the solar capacitor. So now enter other factors. could there be some activity coming in by way of comets, something that might affect the sun? Those things are unpredictable because unless we have the ability to see those, and NASA does. In fact, my next news piece here deals with a new satellite that NASA has launched called the WISE Observatory. It's basically an infrared satellite to measure infrared and map the sky, the deep sky, that is, in the infrared. And that's the heat signatures of very faint objects. And just faint background radiation, galaxies, other objects that are very distant and only giving off what we call heat light, electromagnetic radiation, just like visible light, but much cooler, much less energetic. So at any rate, let me go into that right now, since we're talking about measuring things in the sky. This actually was launched in mid-December. It's called the WISE, W-I-S-E, Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. Let me say that again. Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. Let me just pick each word apart here so you understand what this means. It's a spacecraft launched in mid-December 2009, about a month ago, by NASA. And the wide field part means that there have been prior satellites that, like the Spitzer Space Telescope, also the European Herschel Space Observatory, which observed narrow field of view specific objects like comets or other objects in the solar system, that asteroids, for example, even planets, and observed specific objects with a narrow field of view. So the WISE satellite, it says wide field. So it is a wider field of view and is used for a survey of the universe, looking around in all directions. So in other words, once again, the wide field means it's not a narrow field of view. It's a wider field of view meant for mapping the entire sky. It's in the infrared, which is the I letter, and it is a survey. It is meant to survey the entire sky. So once again, Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, or WISE, spacecraft that was launched by NASA. Now, get this. Isn't this interesting? And I've been waiting for this satellite to be launched for quite some time. These particular satellites apparently take a bit of time to put together and get the launch in place, etc. The Spitzer telescope has been used successfully to study comets, to look at near solar system objects, the same with the European Herschel Space Observatory. But the WISE telescope is going to be used to take a wide survey of the entire sky, and what they hope to find would be comets, asteroids, unknown objects, things that are simply cool. They don't give off a lot of light, but they're out there. And the other thing, get this, WISE, I'm just going to read from the article here. It says, WISE will be looking for dim stars called brown dwarfs and millions of faraway galaxies that are shrouded in dust and often can't be seen in visible light. So they're looking for brown dwarfs. Gee, could that mean possibly Planet X? But also remember that they're looking for comets. But they don't associate that in this article, nor do they make that association in any public venue. But actually, I know for a fact that NASA is secretly looking at the edge of the solar system for objects, big objects, like brown dwarfs or brown dwarf types of objects, Jupiter type of objects, that would be hovering around out there in orbits around the sun, or Planet X, Wormwood. Isn't that interesting? So they're going to be looking with this Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer satellite, the WISE satellite. They're going to be looking for something that I've been predicting for a very long time, that they will see not so much the brown dwarf, but they will see the moving clouds as they come into the solar system and potentially see Planet X. But once again, there are many Planet X's, and if NASA sees one, will it tell the public? Why would it not tell the public? Because there are too many questions that follow. Even if there were some new Planet X type object that was not on an Earth affecting orbit, even if there was not, then would NASA tell the public? Because it's going to raise a lot of questions if they start discovering hundreds or even thousands of big Jupiter sized objects floating around out in the solar system. Wouldn't that raise some severe questions? These objects could have little mini solar systems of their own or moon systems. And if they come into the solar system, they would become huge raging comets as long as they were within the solar capacitor. So at any rate, that actually leads into my next story tonight. And it's something that I do this occasionally to kind of, play with the minds of the disinformation crew. Now, recall that on Christmas Eve, this past Christmas Eve, I did a Christmas Eve special on the Christmas Star. If you have not heard that show, it's a must-listen show. You have to go listen to that show. It's December 24th, 2009. The archives are on my webpage. They're also on the Reality Radio Network webpage. You can get the archives of my show. And also the Scriptures for America archives, my show is there. Number of places you can go to listen to my show. But Christmas Eve, 2009, December 24th, 2009, my radio show is a must listen. And there I talk about the Christmas Star had to have been a comet. And so this is the funny part. Not really funny, but interesting, let's put it that way. My Christmas show occurred, and prior to that, of course, there was a tremendous amount of disinformation trying to convince the public that the Christmas Star was a planetary alignment. And if you go to any of the disinformation search engines like Google, if you go to Wikipedia, the disinformation website, if you go to any place on the internet, it's been very well filtered, so that trying to promote this idea that the Christmas Star was a planetary alignment. So the Christmas show, my special, Christmas Eve special, went through the 10 reasons why the Christmas Star couldn't possibly have been a planetary alignment, but it had to have been a comet. Now, comets are not all that unusual. Comets are people see them, they look like a comet. They've got a tail, they point away from the sun. Not anything very unusual. So what was so unusual about the Christmas Star comet of thousands of years ago that heralded the birth of Christ? What was so unusual about that comet? So I'm going to go through kind of a logical sequence here of events, and I want you to listen to each one of these events in sequence, and then I'm going to put together what I call the punchline, because now all the disinformation shows have been out trying to counter what I had said in my show, my Christmas special. And of course, once again, I was saying that Christmas Star had to have been a comet. And so, as I said, now that all of the disinformation shows have had their shot at trying to state that the Christmas Star was a planetary alignment, and some even, this is funny, some even said it was a UFO. Can you imagine? They will say anything but the truth. Just trying to trap certain people or anybody that believes in UFOs that, oh, it was a Christmas star, it was a UFO. They will say anything but the truth. And now here is a look at the evidence. And it's very interesting. The Pope, at the time that Hale-Bopp came into the solar system, this is back in the early 90s, he was about to release the third letter of Fatima. Now, if you're not familiar with the letters of Fatima, they were letters that were given to three young ladies at the fountain at Fatima by the Virgin Mary. And the last letter had to do with the final destruction and the signs relative to the final destruction of Earth and the final coming of Christ. And the Pope had opened the two letters previous to this and read them to the public, but the third one was apparently so devastating that it was kept secret, even though it was supposed to have been relayed to the public. Well, anyway, at any rate, interestingly enough, it was right about the time that Hale-Bopp came into the solar system that the Pope was about to open the third letter of Fatima. And so that's just an interesting side note. But understand that the people in power, the Pope, the clergy, the secret societies, the people who have guarded secret information for thousands of years and control the world, these people know and understand that comets are very instrumental signs in the heavens, and in fact that the Christmas star, in fact, was a comet. So why would they send out, why would they spend so much time trying to put out misinformation that the Christmas star was a planetary alignment? Well, as I said, listen to my Christmas show. I'm not going to repeat all of the Christmas show here. But it was very interesting. Now, secret societies have known all along that comets are the thing that have changed mankind, that have destroyed the Earth. The Great Flood was when Earth passed through a comet tail for 40 days and 40 nights. The torrential rains came from the comet tail. And so that's why it's hugely important for NASA to maintain this facade of the Dirty Snowball Comet model, even though satellites, NASA's very own satellites, have been right up nose to nose to a comet nucleus, taking pictures of a hot, dry rock, black with a tarry surface on it, no water vapor coming off of it, yet comets are still a dirty snowball. Why is it so important that they maintain that facade? Well, one time, in fact, I was doing a Christmas show with Art Bell about, maybe 8-9 years ago. And I remember I went to a resort to do this. I was it was the Christmas night special, and we were talking about this very topic. And I was saying at the time, and I really thought it, I said, well, the question was, why is NASA guarding this obviously incorrect Dirty Snowball Comet model? And so Art asked me, says, why is this? And I said, well, I think it's just because they have big egos, and there's so much literature, it's in the publication, all the textbooks say this, they've been saying this to the public for 50 years, and they're wrong, and they're just embarrassed, it would be a huge embarrassment. And Art says, no, you know, I don't believe that. I think that eventually someone would crack and science would win out. And he said, something bigger is going on here. And I started to think, and it didn't actually all dawn on me at the time, but yeah, there was something bigger, and there is something bigger going on to this day. Why would NASA continue to deny that the elephant is standing in the room right next to him? That's the old cliche. Well, the reason is because they are controlled. NASA and the scientists are extremely controlled, and the bottom line is that the upper powers that control NASA, that control all of science, that control the information that flows to the public, why would they want the public to believe that comets are dirty snowballs? Because if the public understood in mass that comets do affect the world, have affected the world in a major way in the past, then they would start to look for comets as something that would bring signs of change in the world. Also, the powers that be, so to speak, understand that if the public knew in mass and looked up into the sky and was prepared to see a comet, a big one, and understood, okay, all respect and power to the leaders of the world would vanish overnight. And the one thing that they are paranoid beyond belief about is losing their earthly power. Now, let me continue with the idea that somehow the Christmas star was a comet, but it was a very unusual comet. Now, remember that when Hale-Bopp came in, the Pope had the Vatican had, and the knowledgeable people in the Vatican had an astronomy observatory built in Arizona, and I knew some of the NASA scientists who were commissioned to work there. The question was, and this was something that Father Malachi Martin relayed to us through, once again, through the Art Bell Show, was that the question that was passed on to NASA from the Vatican was, regarding Hale-Bopp, is this wormwood? In other words, is this the return comet? Is this the sign? What did Hale-Bopp have? It had a companion. It had a companion, and that was the sign. Now, lots of comets can have companions, but not that big a comet. Hale-Bopp was actually a medium-sized comet, but it was the fact that all of this slipped out and is now known through my interpretation of the electrical nature of comets, and also the history that the Christmas star was in fact a comet. As I said, listen to my Christmas Eve special for that information. So put one and one and two together and three and four and five together, and you come up with something very interesting. Remember that the wise men looked in the sky and they saw a sign. Well, they had seen comets before. So what was so unusual about this comet? What set it apart from all other comets that said, this is the one, this is the sign? And it occurs to me that the only thing special about a comet that would be so unusual is that it had companions. In a certain pattern, there was something about it that they knew, the secret information that they held, and that is still known in closed circles, the Vatican, other secret society groups that have harbored this knowledge for thousands of years and do not let it out to the public. So the Christmas star, and I'm going to make this speculation, certainly, it was a comet. We already know that. Listen to my Christmas Eve special for that information. It absolutely had to be a comet. But what was so unusual about it? The thing that has to be, and this is also, a lot of times you see, you interpret by people's reactions. And so by looking at the Pope and his reaction, and thank goodness Father Malachi Martin got this information out to the public, where I could get a hold of it and then read through the lines, between the lines, so to speak, is that the Christmas star and the returning of Christ sign in the heaven is a comet with a companion. Now, if you also look at the devastating response that NASA had to the pictures, remember Chuck Schrammick and Courtney Brown produced pictures. Courtney Brown got his from NASA before they understood what this was all about. And Art Bell published them on his webpage and clearly showing the companion to Hale-Bopp. NASA claimed that these were fabricated pictures, and eventually, well, it was a whole political scenario there with the alleged suicide of the Heaven's Gate group. And once again, that clearly those people were murdered because there was a whole complex sequence of events that was going on at the time. Heaven's Gate was not just a small group in California. It was a nearly worldwide network, especially of young people. And they were walking off their jobs, flying to California to meet. Now, the last thing the people in power of this world want to see is a group of people forming in one spot and then potentially communicating with anybody from outside of this planet. And the Pope, by his reaction, tells us that they were very worried that Hale-Bopp was the second coming. He was about to read the third letter of Fatima. You put all of this together and you see the reaction of these people. That tells me that the Christmas star and the sign of the return star, which also would be a comet, is that it has a companion, but not just a companion, a very specific configuration of companions. Now, some people might ask, what happened to the companion of Hale-Bopp? Well, it was there in the comet. You could see the pulsations as it orbited the comet for a very long time. Finally, it orbited as it went through that cloud of debris surrounding the nucleus of Hale-Bopp. Its orbit diminished and diminished until it finally became part of the main nucleus of Hale-Bopp. So the point is that the nucleus of Hale-Bopp and the companion, so to speak, became one. The companion fell into the nucleus eventually, and so that's what happened to the companion of Hale-Bopp, the other chunk. But there were indications that there were other chunks of matter also orbiting Hale-Bopp as it came into the solar system. But there's something extremely unusual in that the three wise men independently understood that the Christmas star was the Christmas star. Something very unusual about it having to do with companions. And this is the sign of the return, of the second return of Christ. And that is why so much effort was put into squelching the idea that Hale-Bopp had a companion. Tremendous amount of lying, deceit, cover-up, NASA taking photos and altering them and then putting them up on web pages to prove that there was no companion. When the Canary Island Conference on Hale-Bopp, the very first topic out of the box was the companion of Hale-Bopp. They knew very well within NASA circles that there was a companion, yet they lied to the public. They accused Art Bell of being responsible for the death of the Heaven Gate group, when in fact he was right in posting the pictures with the companion that Chuck Schrammick and Courtney Brown provided. You can see this, but the bottom line is that the end result is that the Christmas star and the returned sign in the heaven of Christ coming back is a comet with a companion. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and join me next week as we move into this year 2010. I hope I said 2010 at the beginning of this show. And I'm out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroad. Good night.